This is Speaking of Writers. I'm Steve Richards. The book is The Court at War, FDR, His Justices, and the World They Made. The author is Cliff Sloan. The inside story of how one president forever altered the most powerful legal institution in the country with consequences that endure today. Cliff Sloan is a professor of constitutional law and criminal justice at Georgetown University Law Center. He has argued before the Supreme Court 7 times and has served in all 3 branches of the federal government, including a special envoy for Guantanamo closure. He is the author of 2 books. Including The Great Decision, Jefferson, Adams, Marshall, and the Battle for the Supreme Court. His commentary on the Supreme Court and legal issues has appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, Slate, and other publications, and on television and radio as well. Happy to have Cliff Sloan join me now here on Speaking of Writers. Cliff, welcome to this program.
Thanks so much. I'm delighted to be here. I really appreciate it.
So, why this book for you?
Well, you know, as you mentioned, I worked as special envoy for Guantanamo closure. And while I was doing that, I read all the Supreme Court's opinions on military detention, including the very shameful case of Korematsu that upheld the incarceration of Japanese American citizens. And I read a case that preceded Korematsu by a year, Hirabayashi, which was the first of these really abhorrent anti-Japanese decisions. It upheld a criminal curfew targeted at Japanese American citizens. And I noticed that exactly 1 week before Hirabayashi was decided, the Supreme Court decided the famous case of West Virginia Board of Education versus Barnett, where in a very eloquent opinion that's often quoted, Justice Robert Jackson, at the height of World War II, struck down a mandatory flag salute in West Virginia public schools on behalf of what was then a reviled and despised religious minority, the Jehovah's Witnesses. And it really struck me that within exactly 7 days, you had one of the greatest civil liberties decisions in the history of the Supreme Court and one of the worst civil liberties decisions in the history of the Supreme Court. And so I was interested in learning more about the Supreme Court in World War II as a subject. And I started looking into it and I discovered there's very little written on it as a subject. There's a ton written on FDR's battles with the Supreme Court in the 1930s and his failed court packing plan in 1937 and the switch in time that saved 9, where one justice changed his vote to uphold New Deal programs. And then there's a lot written on the Warren Court beginning in 1953 when Earl Warren becomes Chief Justice, but there was very little written on the Supreme Court during World War II. So I started really diving into it, and it turns out to be quite a story because the war dominates everything for the justices. It dominates their personal lives and it dominates all of their opinions, including those that do not explicitly relate to the war.
So, Cliff, it's the summer of 1941, about 6 months away from Pearl Harbor. FDR is in the 9th year of his presidency. So how did he and how does he alter the court at this time?
Well, it's really remarkable because, you know, as I was mentioning, people are generally familiar with FDR's battles with the court in the 30s and his failed court packing plan. But what is less well understood is that by the summer of 1941, due to a wave of resignations and deaths, he had appointed 7 of the 9 justices and elevated an 8th to Chief Justice. There was only one justice on the court who didn't know his position to FDR by the summer of 1941. It was by far the biggest impact on the Supreme Court of any president since George Washington. And it wasn't just the numbers, Steve. The justices that he appointed were extremely close to him. They greatly admired him. They revered him. And he really viewed them as part of his official family, part of his social family, and in some ways part of his bullpen that he could draw on for non-judicial policy matters while they were doing their duties on the Supreme Court. So it was really a kind of extraordinary relationship between FDR and these justices. And World War II is really the time of the pure Roosevelt Court, because soon after FDR dies in 1945 and soon after the end of World War II, a number of justices either resign or die. And so by 1949, Harry Truman has appointed four justices, almost half of the court. So the war is really the time of the pure Roosevelt court.
And probably the only time in history, you mentioned the relationship he had with these justices, that a president was this close to the justices, right?
Yes, it was really exceptional. I mean, you have other instances in our history where a president might be close to a particular justice, but the range and the depth of it are really the only time we've seen this, where almost all of the justices had these extremely close relationships and where FDR felt very comfortable involving them in non-judicial policy matters.
It's described that this court had two faces. Why did they have two faces?
Well, and you're absolutely right. You know, it's a tale of two courts. It's the best of courts and the worst of courts. And they both relate to the war. On the best of courts side of things, there's a series of decisions by the Supreme Court during World War II, where in self-conscious contrast to our enemies, the totalitarians, the fascists, the Nazis, in a series of cases, the court protected and recognized and expanded constitutional rights and liberties. This is what made us different from the people we were fighting. And so you have, for example, in 1942, an opinion striking down a compulsory sterilization law for habitual criminals in Oklahoma. And it's really the first time the court recognizes a fundamental liberty interest in the decision whether to have children or not, in reproductive choice. But it decides it very much in the context of the widespread awareness that Hitler and the Nazis have been engaged in this massive program of forced sterilization in the interest of racial purity and racial improvement. And in fact, the prisoners who faced imminent sterilization and their lawyers said that if the Oklahoma law is upheld, it will represent the Hitlerization of American law. And that was the way it was kind of widely understood and discussed at the time. And just to give a couple more examples on the best of courts side of things, I mentioned the Barnett decision, where the Supreme Court struck down the mandatory flag salute. And in that opinion, Justice Robert Jackson, where he famously said, in our system of government, in our constitutional democracy, no government official can tell you what you have to think or believe. And that is, quote, a fixed star in our constitutional constellation. But he also said, this is what distinguishes us from, quote, our totalitarian enemies. They're the ones who try to compel unity of thought and belief. And he even pointed out that the mandatory flag salute that West Virginia had adopted had the children standing with their hands facing the flag. And he pointed out the very close resemblance of that flag salute to the Nazi salute. I actually have a picture of that flag salute in the book. And then similarly, in 1944, the Supreme Court strikes down the all-white Democratic primary in Texas and throughout the South. It's Thurgood Marshall's first big victory in a case that he argues in the Supreme Court. And again, it's very much a part of the way that the case is seen and discussed and reported on and argued by Thurgood Marshall, that we're fighting a regime that's premised on racial supremacy. And World War II is actually a time of great sort of civil rights ferment and turmoil on the home front. And the African-American community had adopted what it called the double V campaign, victory over fascism abroad and racism at home. And that was all part of the context of that decision. And on the other hand, on the worst of court side of things, you have, again, these shameful anti-Japanese decisions that are a deep, deep stain on the Supreme Court and on the country. There was also a case involving accused Nazi saboteurs where the sort of procedural route was very much short-circuited, and FDR was very involved in it. He wanted these saboteurs convicted and executed as soon as possible, and the Supreme Court accommodated him, even allowing the convictions and executions to go forth before they had figured out the reasons for their decision. And there were then they got into all sorts of bitter internal fights after six of the saboteurs had been executed about how they would justify. And the difference between the best of courts and the worst of courts, in my view, is that with decisions like those involving forced sterilization and flag salutes and the all-white primaries, the justices didn't have to cross FDR, and they didn't have to cross him on a war issue. And they were just completely unwilling to do that because FDR and his administration were very much involved in both the anti-Japanese cases and the Nazi saboteur case. And, you know, for me, it really illustrates the judicial disaster, catastrophe that can result when justices are unwilling to stand up to the president who appointed them, or that president's political supporters, political network, political patrons. And I think that's an especially important lesson today, at a time when the votes of the justices correlate with the preferences of the political party of the president who appointed them more than at any time in our history.
You've touched on some of the justices. It's a cast of unforgettable characters here. I want to ask you about a couple of others. Felix Frankfurter, what was he like?
Yeah, so Frankfurter was really a kind of remarkable character. He had devoted his life to the Supreme Court. He had been a professor at Harvard Law School. He also had a couple government positions. He had written extensively about the court. He was close to Supreme Court icons like Oliver Wendell Holmes and Louis Brandeis. And beginning when FDR was governor of New York, they were very, very close. And FDR loved, you know, Frankfurter was very voluble and was always throwing out ideas. FDR one time said that Felix Frankfurter has more ideas per minute than anybody he's ever met. And when FDR got elected, Frankfurter was very involved in placing his proteges and disciples in high-level positions throughout the government. They were called Felix's happy hot dogs. And he was very involved in just about every policy activity, whether it was labor policy or foreign policy. And he would get together with the happy hot dogs, as well as other prominent people in government. And when FDR appointed him to the Supreme Court in 1939, he continued all of those activities, both with FDR. He would constantly send him letters, "Dear Frank," giving him advice on a wide range of policy issues, meet with him all the time, be in touch, you know, with all the people throughout government. But Frankfurter also thought that it was his natural fate and destiny to be leading the Supreme Court, and that the other justices would just fall in line behind him. And when that didn't happen, and in fact, kind of rival blocks developed among the FDR appointees, Frankfurter became very bitter and disenchanted. And in fact, during much of the war, he kept a diary. And in the diary, he's thrilled at this wide range of policy activities that he continues to be involved in, but he's very disappointed about what's happening on the court. And he records every perceived slight and grievance from people like Hugo Black and William O. Douglas. And he even takes to calling them the Axis. Now, this is at the height of World War II, when we're fighting the Axis nations of Germany, Italy, and Japan. It's a little as if after 9/11, one justice started calling other justices Al-Qaeda. But it was not a one-way street, because there are notes from Douglas to one of the lesser known justices, Frank Murphy, in this period, where he refers to Frankfurter as Der Führer and the little bastard.
Douglas is interesting too. Douglas was actually FDR's initial pick to be a running mate in 1944. What was he like?
Yeah, so this is fascinating. I mean, Douglas had kind of a meteoric rise when FDR appointed him in 1939. He was the next selection after Frankfurter. He had already been chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission at FDR's appointment. And FDR was very close to Douglas. Douglas was part of his regular poker circle. He said two things he greatly enjoyed about Douglas were that he told wonderful stories, and also, and this was very important to FDR, that Douglas made the best martinis of anybody in Washington. But in 1944, as FDR was gearing up to run for his fourth term, he had decided to sack his vice president, Henry Wallace. And so he was looking for a new running mate. And he initially very much favored Douglas. And he told his political advisors he wanted Douglas. He thought Douglas would be very appealing. He liked Douglas's humble upbringing in the Pacific Northwest, the way Douglas carried himself in public. He was even a little infatuated with Douglas. He told his advisors about how Douglas's hair blew in the wind. And Douglas, the political advisors, in turn, were very skeptical of Douglas because Douglas had never run for political office. And the head of the Democratic National Committee was from Missouri and was close to Harry Truman. So they were pushing for Truman. And then finally, in the convention week in Chicago, FDR nominally leaves it up to the convention to decide who his running mate will be. But he releases a letter that week where he says he would be very happy to run with either Felix Frankfurter. He would be very happy to run with either Harry Truman or William O. Douglas. Those were the only two names on the letter. And so right up until the last day of the convention, Douglas was viewed as a leading candidate to be vice president, and in some accounts, the leading candidate. Douglas himself wasn't at the convention in Chicago, but there were a group of people who were very close to Douglas who were there at the convention, working around the clock, trying to get him the nomination. Now, this is all while Douglas is a sitting justice, this very direct and very prominent involvement in a high-level political campaign.
In our remaining moments here with Cliff Sloan, his new book is The Court at War, FDR's Justices and the World They Made. So, Cliff, what was the indelible mark that this war court left on the legal landscape?
Well, the decisions from the best of courts really gave us foundations that have dominated the constitutional structure for the next three quarters of a century. Very, very important opinions. Now, some of them are very much at issue today, but just to give examples from the cases we talked about, the forced sterilization law, striking that down, that became a cornerstone, not only in reproductive freedom, but in other personal liberty cases. So it's cited and relied on in Roe versus Wade. It's also cited in other reproductive rights decisions. It's also cited and relied on in the interracial marriage decision. It's cited and relied on in the same-sex marriage decision. And of course, now we have Dobbs overruling Roe versus Wade, but the dissenters in Dobbs point to Skinner and what an important landmark it is, and express concern that it's being threatened by Dobbs. West Virginia Board of Education versus Barnett, a lasting and indelible precedent in terms of the protection of persecuted religious minorities and the importance of civil liberties. And Smith versus Allwright, which was the case striking down the all-white Democratic primary, was a very important voting rights case and a very important civil rights case. Many historians think that that case launched a trajectory that resulted 10 years later in Brown versus Board of Education. And it also was very, very important in kind of fundamental voting rights decisions in the Supreme Court, and continues to be very important as a kind of basic cornerstone of the constitutional guarantee of voting rights.
The book is The Court at War, FDR, His Justices, and the World They Made. The author is Cliff Sloan. Cliff, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Steve. I really appreciate it. Take care.
And this is Speaking of Writers.